Okay, Lawrence Lessford asked a question last week about the belief in the devil, if that is a major violation of Torah. For that, I make reference to Leviticus 17, 7. Okay? So, it says, in Leviticus 17, 7, now here you see where the Torah, the Torah insists, and Leviticus 17, by the way, is where the Torah gives a very serious penalty for anyone that slaughters an animal outside of the tabernacle or the temple. Okay, and that's where that's in the verses 1 through 6. Okay, it's interesting just to look through those verses because here we have. Here we have the halachic system combined with the philosophical system. It says, first it mentions that the what the violation is, anybody that slaughtered an animal outside of the temple and failed to bring it in, did not bring it into the to the place of slaughter in the temple. So it says, this is verse 4, it says, blood shall be it should be considered as if this person has slaughtered, killed somebody. Like it's such a serious violation. It's as if he's sacrificed his own blood. In other words, that the Torah is just emphasizing how serious it is, because it means to say he sacrificed his own blood means that he is deservant of death. Okay, that's what it says. Blood shall be considered unto that person. He and the man spilled blood. Okay, it's as if he did the worst violation. It's as if he committed murder, and as if he put his own life on the line to jeopardize his very life. And then the Bible says, and the Torah says, and this man shall be cut off from the midst of his nation. Now that's one of the most serious penalties that the Torah meets out, and that is the punishment is called kares in Hebrew. It means where the person is cut off completely. And the Torah continues, and it says in verse 5, it says, in order that the children of Israel should bring their sacrifices, which they sacrifice on the field, they should bring them to God, to the entrance of the entrance of the court of the tabernacle. And then it says, and they shall slaughter sacrifices of a peace offering to God. Okay? And then it says, and the Kohen shall sprinkle the blood on the altar of God in the entrance of the court of the tabernacle. And he should sacrifice, and he should, in other words, he should bring place on the altar the fat for a as an incense to God. And then, okay, so here we don't understand why this elaboration. And verse 6, for instance, verse 5 and 6, what is the Torah getting at? The Torah has a point here. And then verse 7 clears it up, because verse 7 explains. It says, they shall not continue to sacrifice their sacrifices. In Hebrew it says, la'se'irim, which means basically to the devils, you see, which they are turning after. And this is an everlasting law for your generation. This shall be an everlasting law for them forever for their generations. Okay? Now here we see, if we just look into it a little bit deeper, we'll see what the Torah is saying basically. The Torah permits sacrifice. But the Torah recognized that in sacrifice there's also a danger, because sacrifice could bring a person into the world of the primitive. So therefore, the Torah says that anyone, what the Torah wanted to prevent was people having their own personal sacrifices. Everybody in their own backyard is going to have their own sacrifice. Now what happens is that each person gets into his own thing, his own emotions, his own fantasies, and then he he's completely away from reality, and he goes into his own ideas, his own nonsensical ideas, and oftentimes idolatrous ideas. This, if this happens, then people are, then the whole system is in danger, the whole system is destroyed. That's why the Torah placed such a serious penalty on anyone. It doesn't seem like, you know, the Torah usually gives a serious penalty, the crime has to be serious. So over here, what did he do? He just sacrificed something to God outside of the temple. What's so terrible about that? Why did the Torah come down on this man and say it's as if he spilled blood and his life is, he's jeopardizing his whole life, he's cut off from the nation? What is the reason for that? The reason is because, as it says in verse 5, they must bring their sacrifices to the entrance of the tabernacle, and the Kohen, the priest, shall sprinkle the blood. In other words, when it's under the halachic system, then it's safe. Then there is no danger. But if each person goes on in his own private little world and starts bringing sacrifices to God, then the whole system is in danger, because then people are doing their own little thing. And there is a tremendous instinct in man to do his own private little thing with God. You see, that concept, by the way, itself, that emotion itself is an idolatrous emotion, because the true emotion is that a person should never think of himself as being special to God, or he's doing something special with God, whether it's him or whether it's a group of people. That is prohibited, because a person must realize that God is universal. God is for everyone, and there's no way that a person can just gain the favor of God. That's an idolatrous idea. You see, the idol worshippers always try to propitiate the gods, and they try to become the god's favorite. That's a childish, infantile notion that the Torah wants to wipe out. So that's why the Torah says sacrifices are okay, provided they're brought where? At the temple, where you have the Sanhedrin, where you have the wise men of Israel, the scholars of Talmud, the scholars of Torah, where you have the priests that are operating specifically according to the whole system of halacha. So the man is surrounded with the system of halacha. There's no danger of him escaping into his own little private world and making this a little private sacrifice between him and God, and to cater to those primitive emotions. Not only that, what eventually will happen is that, as the Torah says, that these people once it becomes a private affair away from the universals of halacha, away from the wisdom of the scholars, what happens is then people start getting certain fears. They sacrifice to the devil because they start thinking that there are other powers out there besides God. And once that happens, then the whole system obviously has deteriorated and has become an idolatrous system. So therefore, you see how the Torah, step by step, protects. The Torah is very well aware of what the dangers to its own system are. And that's why the Torah protects against that. But in the verse, you take a look at the verse 7, where it tells you what the ultimate danger is. The ultimate danger is that they should sacrifice to the devils, and it says, which they are turning after. Okay? Which means to say that the Torah recognizes that there is this that there is this nature in man to want to believe that there are these other forces and there are these other powers. And Ibn Ezra says very, very nicely, the great interpreter of the Torah, he says, anyone that searches for these devils, he says the word Se'irim in Hebrew means goats, literally. And he says, because many of them, when they see these devils, they appear to them as in the form of goats. Now, I guess, today, more like werewolves or whatever, but different animals in different periods, I guess, assume the figure of these powers and these forces. So he says, anyone that searches after them or believes in them, he is turning away from his God, because he thinks that there is someone else that could either harm him or do good for him besides the Creator. Okay? And that is, Ibn Ezra isn't really taking it very far away from the text itself, which, because the text says they shall not sacrifice their sacrifices to these devils, which they are, and the next word is zonim, in Hebrew means to turn away, which is always used, whenever that word is used, it always means to turn away from God to something else. The word for a harlot in Hebrew is zona. That means, because she turns away from her husband towards other people. So the same thing, that word is always used to indicate a turning away from the true path to the path which the Torah is against. And that's why Ibn Ezra says, anyone who searches, who looks for those devils, who believes in them, has turned away from God because he maintains that there's another force in the universe that can either benefit him or harm him. And that's really, if you just look through that chapter 17, you'll see that idea is there, because the Torah recognizes that this is a tremendous danger to the system, and that's why there was a prohibition against private sacrifices. Private is bad. Private is where the world goes into the person goes into the world of his own imaginations. Then he starts believing different crazy, nonsensical things, and it becomes a private affair between him and God, where his imagination becomes reality. And this is what the Torah says is the worst thing. That's why anyone that did that offense was cut off from the just all he had to do was just to have a private sacrifice. That's it. He was cut off from the nation. Okay. So I wanted to bring that to your attention, and to your understanding that this, what Lawrence mentioned last week, that this is belief in a devil is really, as the Torah says, sacrificing to the devils. Belief in that devil is turning away completely from God. So this is an important thing. By the way, the word, the reason why you have, for instance, in the New Testament and the other religions, you have this idea of a devil, is really because that it is idolatrous and it is pagan, and that's where it comes from. But the Torah is considers that to be the worst offense. The wrong idea of God is the worst offense, a denial of God. Okay. By the way, the word Satan does not have a mystical meaning. That's something which was introduced mainly by Christians who believed in devils and being tempted by the devil and all these kind of things. They really made the word Satan into a mystical thing. But if you take a look in the prophets itself, for instance, if you take a look at 1 Kings 11:14, okay? So in 1 Kings 11:14, it states, and God set up a Satan to Solomon. And what is it? It says Hadad, the Edomite, who was from the seed of the kings in Edom, which means that this man was a Satan to Solomon. Why? Because he was always his adversary, his enemy, and he would try whenever he could to harm the people of Israel. So you see, the word Satan doesn't mean a mystical thing. It means it's a person. It's a physical thing. And it's not mystical at all. If the word Satan really meant something exclusive, separate, and mystical, you couldn't say it would be like saying Russia is a Satan to America. I mean, not now perhaps, but a couple of years ago, certainly a few years ago, before downfall of the of communism. But the Satan means simply a person. This was an individual, a person. And you have that. You have it again in 11:23, in Kings 11:23. So again in 11:25. I mean, this is in 5:18 also. You have it there also. It says there is no Satan. It means there's no adversaries. The word Satan comes from hatred. In Genesis, it says, and Esau hated Jacob, so it uses that word vayistom. So there, it's S-T-M, and that's the origin of the many times the M and the N are interchangeable. So in Hebrew, so the word Satan really comes from hatred, an adversary, but it has no mystical meaning. That's why the rabbis, the scholars of the oral law, say that the Satan is the angel of death. He is the evil inclination. And it is Satan is the evil inclination, and it is the angel of death. Now, what does it mean when they say that it's the evil inclination and the angel of death? What's in common there? What it means is it's the instinctual part of man. The instinctual part of man is physical, and anything physical has its limitation. Just like in the animal kingdom, the animals live and they die. And that part of man, which is instinctual, is part of the physical, biological world, and that's why it's the angel of death, because it's intrinsically limited. A person only can live a certain amount of time, just like an animal. An animal has a lifespan. In that respect, man is exactly the same as the animal kingdom. He also has a lifespan, and that part of him, which is the evil inclination, which is the instinctual force, is simply a part of his instinctual nature, which is a natural part of the natural world. So that's why the rabbis say immediately that Satan is nothing, is not a mystical force, and we're not allowed to believe in that. It is simply when the Bible, when the prophets refer to Satan, or when the scholars refer to Satan, what they usually mean is their reference is usually to the instinctual part of man.
All right, Rabbi.
The evil inclination. But there's nothing mysterious about it. It's a natural force, an instinctual force. It can be studied. It can be learned. It can be understood. And that's why you have King Solomon. As David mentioned to me this week, we were discussing the in Ecclesiastes, where he said he studied wickedness. He studied the frivolity and all different aspects of human life. But these are nothing mysterious. They are something which are deep, and we have to understand. Need understanding and knowledge, but they are not any. They are not a mystical force.
Rabbi,
yes.
We got a noise. All right, Rabbi.
Yes.
Can you hear me? Lawrence has another question. He wanted to know who the Satan or the adversary was in Job 1.
Okay. I knew that question was coming.
Yeah, you knew that. Okay.
So I knew that.
You're a smart guy. All right, wait a minute. Let me give you another one.
Okay.
In Zechariah chapter 3.
Right.
And he showed me Joshua, the high priest, standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan,
mm-hmm.
the Satan, or the adversary, at his right hand. That's
right.
Zechariah 3.
Okay. I'm not going to answer the question in specific, but I'll tell you in general.
Okay.
Okay?
All right. Well, go ahead.
It's like Maimonides states in his guide. He says, if you ask somebody, you wake them up from their sleep and you say, look, would you like to know what an angel is? They'll say, yeah, certainly. Well, then if you tell them, well, it's going to take a while, because first you have to study the basics. And then after the basics, you have to get into more advanced knowledge of Torah. And then when you get into that area, you have to gain knowledge of knowledge in general of the natural world. Then you and on and on and on. And then the person would say, well, I think I'm going to go back to sleep, because people are very excited about knowing what an angel is. It sounds intriguing, but when you explain to them that this process is a long process because it requires a lot of knowledge, then they're not interested anymore. Now, what I want to say is this. That when you read things in the prophets, you have to be careful. You have to realize when a prophet is telling you a vision, you are not on the level of that prophet. That prophet is light years away from us in terms of his knowledge. So when he's giving these descriptions, you would be a complete fool to think that this is just a simple literal thing which you can understand. That is pure nonsense. That's why Solomon, in the beginning of Proverbs, makes it clear, and I think everyone should read those first few verses, where he states that that to understand the parables of the wise people, that was the style of the way to convey an idea to people so that the foolish people don't understand it and the intelligent ones do, is by way of parable. That was the method that was used. That's the method in the Torah. That's the method in the prophets. So when a person, you take a verse in Zechariah, you have to understand what that whole thing is about, and then you'll understand what it means by Satan, okay? Because it's a parable. It is not a literal story. The same thing is true with Job. And as a matter of fact, most of the scholars of the Talmud maintain Job never existed. The man never existed. There was no such man as Job, according to many, many scholars of the Talmud. And we have a tradition that maintains that book was written by Moses, because The essence of the book is actually it's the greatest self-criticism of religion that there is, because it really breaks down some of the common notions of religion. It attacks it. And Moses wrote that book because that is the book that deals with reward and punishment. And God's, what does it mean when we say God gives reward and punishment? Also, a simple idea. Not so simple. Not so simple. Moses wrote a book on it. It's not simple. Okay? Now, when it gives you that instance in the beginning where it says that the Satan came before God's court, if you think that there are little things up there in the sky, there's a court up there in the sky, and there's this little guy with a, you know, an evil look in his face that is coming before the court, that is silly. That's childish. You have to understand what the parable is of Job. What's the concept? What is it trying to say? Then you'll be able to understand what Satan is, what Satan means, what it refers to. It's a reference, okay? Now, if you'd like to do that, I can do that. But we would have to go into the whole backdrop of what Job is in order to be able to understand the concept over there. I wouldn't do it right now in this tonight, but if you'd like to do it another time, I'd be glad to do it with you. But it is a separate thing. The point I want to make is you can't just take words out of Satan was a what? It's an evil force. There is the principal idea. If there were such a concept, and this is important, as I mentioned this many times, when you look at the written word of the Torah, there's one principle we have from the oral law, from the scholars, from the rabbis, and there is no doubt that it's straight from Sinai, and that is nothing is added after the five books of Moses. Nothing. That's why the five books of Moses end not when the Jews enter the promised land, as the historians think it should end, because it's not a story about the promised land. The Torah is a story about prophecy of the greatest of all prophets, which is Moses. And as soon as Moses' prophecy ends, that's the end of the five books, because the five books are the word of God, and there is nothing that is ever added to those five books. Nothing. No prophet can ever add a word. So the question is, what is the prophets? The prophets are simply elaborations on themes that already exist in the five books, but there is nothing new in the prophets. Now, do you see anywhere in the five books that the Torah makes a reference to a devil? Don't you think that if there was such a thing, and in any religion that believes in the devil occupies a primary area of the religion. It's not a small thing. That the religions that have devil, that's a big thing. If there's such a thing, it's going to be a central thing. Do you find in the five books of Moses anywhere such an idea? That is alien to it. It's completely alien to the five books of Moses. If there were such a thing, the Torah would state it openly. Would say, look, there's a devil, and you have to watch out. If there's such and such, not one word is mentioned. On the contrary, from what I showed you from Leviticus, is exactly the opposite. That the people worship the devils, and the purpose of the Torah is to remove them from that kind of a practice. So you could see from the five books that there cannot be such a thing. Now in the prophets, especially Job, where it's giving you as the rabbis say, Job never existed. It is a parable. It is a parable. It's just a story. Because in truth, many maintain that such a thing would never happen to a person. But the question, it was raised as a question, introduced as a story. The story is there for philosophical story, but it's not a real story, according to most. And even if it were a real story, when you find things like that in the prophets, you have to understand those are allusions to ideas and concepts that require depth of understanding, not silly kind of things like devils and things like that. If there was such a belief, it would be in the five books. As I said, there can be nothing after the five books of Moses. Nothing new. Okay, only elaborations. So it's pretty obvious that that when you find Satan, no one's making a new discovery in Job that didn't exist in the five books. And it's obvious in the five books itself there is no such concept. Okay, were it there, as I said before, it would be of primary importance, and it would certainly be mentioned in the Torah itself. So what I'm trying to show you is that any kind of analysis of this idea of devil leads to the clear conclusion that there is no such phenomenon, and anyone who believes in such a phenomenon is turning away from God. The entire Torah only says one thing, repeats it again and again, that there is one way for a person to have to have a good life, and that is to follow the commandments and the ways of God. That is it. There is nothing else to do. If there's one thing the Torah tries to impress upon a person, if a person just reads through the Bible itself, they will find that keeping God's statutes, His laws, His Torah, following His ways, that is the only salvation. There is nothing else to be concerned about. Zero. Okay? And the Torah states, and in the reading that we did last week in Deuteronomy, it says, you shall be complete with your God. What does it mean, you should be complete? It means you shouldn't have any of your energies diversified anywhere else, to any other forces, any other superstitions. That is mentioned in that area where we took up last week in Deuteronomy, if you remember. That we're going to get back to that. But the final verse over there is that you should be complete with God, whole with God. What does that mean? After it mentions the superstitions, the violations of superstitions, magic, sorcery, all kinds of seances, all these different things, the Torah sums it up in one sentence, you should be complete with your God, which means to say that if you believe any of these type of things, like if a person believes there are any other force, like a black cat, a superstition, then he's turning away from God in that. So if that's turning away from God, how much more is belief in a devil, an actual force that can that exists, a supernatural force that exists besides God? There's no more turning away from God than that. And that's why the Torah actually uses that term, and that's what the Ibn Ezra mentions. It uses the term zonah, which means to turn away from God. Okay. So that's the point. My point is, when you read prophets, you have to remember, we are not on the level of a prophet. We try, that's why through the interpretation, through study, you'll see, you'll be able to make sense out of what the word adversary means there. It means, it does not mean another supernatural force. But if you wish, I could take it up, maybe I'll take it up next week, because I just want to show you that mystical idea. But right now I'd like to get back to what we were doing, unless you have any further questions on this point, which I would accept. Okay?
I think that was okay.
Okay.
And I think that was an adequate explanation. I would add to that in order to understand this, I think you have to understand God's system of reward and punishment and the
right.
providence of God.
That's correct.
And realize that God is in control, and He uses different means and different people to bring about His ultimate goal.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you begin to teach that, you've got more to talk about than we can do in 30 minutes.
Yes, that's true. If the people would like me to come back to this on the Job thing, I can.
Okay.
But I have to get into the whole picture of Job, what it's all about, and at least the basics of it. So that would be like a separate class.
Is it time to turn the tape on?
Okay.
All right. Well, we've got about 30 seconds, and then we're going to turn the tape.
Okay.
And then Charlie has a question that he would like to ask after we turn the tape, okay?
Okay.
So now I have talked for the 30 seconds almost, so we can turn the tape. All right. Okay. All right. Here's Charlie McKinn. He has a question he'd like to ask.
How you doing?
Okay, Charlie. How's it going?
Fine. I liked your explanation, and I fully understood what you're getting at with Satan, the adversary, and that sort of thing. The question I've got is, I'd like for you to somehow give us some sort of a Reader's Digest of the five books. You commented that this is where we can be the happiest and have a good life, knowing that you're trying to do the right thing. When in the five books, primarily when you get out of the first part of Genesis, it seems to develop or to go along the lines of the walk of the children of Israel, and using stories and things that's sort of hard to relate in today's economy. So, I mean, how do you interpret those things when our lifestyles are considerably different as far as what we do on a day-to-day basis And how can we glean from the five books there when so much of it has to do with the children of Israel, and they were to do certain things and not do certain things, and has to do with sacrifices, which, as you know, it's at least not practiced today. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if I'm making my question clear enough, but it I can buy fully, at least myself, the thing about Satan the adversary. I followed it along with your teaching and other things that we've heard heretofore, okay. And it makes sense.
Okay.
I guess now I'm ready to look ahead to what makes life more enjoyable. I know you keep reiterating, you know, follow the Torah, practice the Torah, and this sort of thing.
Okay.
And it seems that it's easier said and done with the Jew than it is me.
Okay.
So, you know,
I'll address that.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, Charlie's question really, and if I could sum it up, try to sum it up properly, of course, it did involve a lot of areas. But the question basically to me seems to be, in what way can we take the Torah? Can the Torah be relevant to us and give us a truly good life, a life, and we know that the Torah says, and the Torah mentions many, many times, the Torah actually differs from any other religion in this respect, glaringly. The Torah does not say anywhere in the five books, you should serve God because you're going to go to paradise, you're going to go to heaven. Does not mention that at all. As a matter of fact, the Torah emphasizes that you should serve God because you will have a good life here, right in the here and now. And the reason is because the belief, again, the belief in a paradise, in a heaven, is also usually is really a primitive idea. You'll see that the most primitive nations and religions always have this paradise. What they do is it's an exchange. In other words, their gods tell them to make sacrifices during this life, and then they pay them back in the next life. Nothing could be further from the truth, according to Torah and according to Judaism. We don't have a payback system where God wants you to suffer here, you're going to pay back. No, God wants you to live a correct life here and a good life here. And there's no payback. On the contrary, if you live a good life here, you will have a better life there, because that part of you which is eternal will be activated, and therefore your existence is not terminated by your physical death. Okay, but it's not an exchange concept. It's not that. That's why the Torah never tries to lure people into believing and being religious because God's going to pay them back in the next world. The Torah does not do that. It will not be found in the five books of Moses again. And the other religions, you'll see, always put that lure of paradise there. I mean, Christianity goes without saying. The New Testament is full of it. But the five books of Moses does not have a word of it, because the true religion, Judaism, wants man to do what's right, because if it's right, it's right for him here insofar as he's a man. It's right in this life, and he will have the best life here. We don't have to talk about what's going to happen afterwards. That is a metaphysical, that's a metaphysical study. We do believe that the soul does not die. The soul of man does not die like the animals does, with the passing on of the body, because we believe that man is in tune with an eternal part of his nature, the part that perceives wisdom, knowledge, ideas, and concepts that are not physical. And that part of him can't die, because that part of him is not physical. The only thing that dies is that which is physical. But that is not why a person should be religious, and the Torah never tries to use that as motivation. The Jews, the people of Israel, came out of Egypt where the motivation was always the afterlife, the tomb, the tombs of the pharaohs and the the pyramids. I'm sorry, word escaped me. The pyramids show that the whole life of the Egyptian was motivated by death. That's why he lived. He lived for one reason, so that after he dies, he's going to have a great life. The Torah took the people of Israel out of Egypt, out of that society, away from that concept, and it told the people, live over here. If you live properly, this life can be a great life. and the person will have afterlife, but that's not a motivation. A motivation should be because this is the right way for man to live. If man is an organism and there is a right way to live, and that right way is Torah, then it must give him the right life here, because he's an organism, and there must be a certain prescription for the proper life. Now, what Charlie's asking is, how does that work for the Ben Noach? Okay, how does the Bible, which the setting of the Bible is so different than the modern setting, so how could we relate to that? My answer is the following: that it's true. Abraham traveled through a desert, and Abraham traveled. He rode on a camel, and we ride in cars. In that respect, there's no question that our setting is different. But the Torah maintains an important principle. That is, it doesn't matter what the setting is. Man is always the same. And since man is the same, and man's dilemmas, man's problems mainly are not external ones. Okay, that's a mistake. That is propaganda of our society. Our society will try to teach you that the problems of man are external. It is not true. The problems of man are totally internal. A person could be living in a lap of luxury and be ready to commit suicide. It has nothing, his happiness has very little to do. Once you get beyond the basic necessities of life, then the human being's happiness has 100% more to do with his internal state than with the external state. And the increase in luxuries, or whether you drive a car, whether you fly across this planet, doesn't make any difference in terms of the internal person. It doesn't affect them one iota. The internal man can only be affected by one thing: proper knowledge, proper ideas. I was reading recently Lee Iacocca's book. He's an intelligent man, a very successful businessman, obviously. And when I read his ideas on religion, you know, I mean, he's not a religious man, but he has little notions. They were about the age of a five-year-old, probably. I mean, not much more advanced than that. And I thought to myself, I could read between the lines in his book that he's getting older and he's facing certain personal dilemmas. And there's no way for him to get out of them because he has no ideas that are of any consequence or any value for a human being. So the point the Torah makes is that the way a person has a good life is by acquiring the proper ideas. It doesn't matter what the setting is. You could be in the desert, you could be in a tent, you could be anywhere you might want to be. It doesn't make any difference. The setting really doesn't make any difference. The difference is what goes on inside the person. And what goes on inside the person is dependent upon one thing: knowledge. That's what it's dependent upon. Knowledge in two forms: knowledge of what is right and abstract, and knowledge of yourself, your own emotions, your own instincts, your own inclinations, honesty with yourself. Then that kind of knowledge is the only kind of knowledge that can make a person happy. And the Torah is really a guiding light for that kind of knowledge. That's why you have the stories of Abraham. Last year, if you remember, we took the story of Abraham, what it meant to leave his home and his homeland and the house of his father. And those emotions exist today, the same emotions. And the fear that a person has when he enters new ground, he leaves the comforts of the old religion, the old way, the nice warm feelings that people have around the holiday times. All these kind of things are powerful emotions. The story of Abraham, where Abraham had to uproot himself, completely disassociate himself from all these kind of emotions, even from the house of his father. That was a challenge, tremendous challenge. That challenge exists today. Same way, no difference. I don't care if you're living in a mansion or if you're living in a tent. It makes no difference. Those emotions are always there. The internal man never changes. Now, the second half of the question that Charlie asked was how the Ben Noach can profit from the Torah as much as the Ben Israel. With regard to that, I have the following response, and that is that the main way that the Ben Israel benefits from the Torah is, again, through study and knowledge. that is the most important of all the commandments. And that's the one. I mean, when you study, if you just read, you know, Christians introduce Bible reading. Bible reading is not really is not a Torah concept. We have Bible studying, you see, studying. And even when the Torah was read, which was a law that was instituted by Moses to make sure the 3 days don't go by without reading the Torah, but the Torah was read and also it was interpreted. It wasn't just read. Because without understanding, there's no value. Now, that reading was supposed to be something which got the people interested, motivated, so now they come home. I mean, this is something that happens to me, and I'm sure to many other people. You know, you go to synagogue and you look at listen to the reading, and then you come and say, just a minute, what was that law over there? How did that work? And then you get involved, you start thinking and understanding. Or if it's a story, it catches your eye. So then you start looking, and the way, of course, to analyze is not simply to just take a Bible and look at it or try to imagine your own things. You have to go to those who have the inside track of Torah, and that is the scholars of the oral law. You have to study them. And when you study them, you'll see they open up new panoramas, new vistas of what's going on behind the scenes in the Bible and the Torah. And it gives a new depth of psychology and philosophy. And if a person, halacha is a beautiful science. It's a science all its own. And when a person is, the epitome of man is really the, what is the highest, the greatest man? The greatest man is the scholar, but not, I hate to use the word scholar, because scholar today has a different meaning, different connotation. The scholar means, in the Torah's terms, means the endlessly inquisitive mind. That's what a scholar is. As a matter of fact, the word for scholar is students of the wise. Students, a student, not an authority. Scholar today has an authority, because in our world, everything's an ego. You have the PhD, you have your degree, you're a professor, you're world famous, you're this, you're that, Nobel Prize winner, all this kind of nonsense. The Torah doesn't deal with nonsense. The Torah thinks the epitome of man is not a person who considers himself an authority. And that's not an authority. We have to have authority, because you have to have knowledge, so you have to go to a person that has the most knowledge. But the greatest authority is the greatest student. He thinks of himself as a student. What are his interests in life? Not to be a leader. His interest, the greatest interest that he has, is to pursue knowledge to a further degree. If he happens to be in a situation of leadership, fine. If he's not, he is even happier. As a matter of fact, you remember very well the story with Moses, how Moses declined. He refused to be the leader of the entire people. Now I ask you, if God would come to any person today and say, look, you are going, I want you to be the leader of the world. I want you to now lead the way to my name and my glory. Would anybody turn this down? They'd be tickled pink. Not Moses. Moses was not happy. Why? Because Moses was not waiting for an ego trip. That's why it says the man Moses was the most humble man on the face of the earth. Because he wasn't interested in the ego trip. He was interested in the burning bush. He was interested in understanding metaphysics and understanding ideas. He was drawn to questions. He wanted to gain more knowledge, an endless pursuit of knowledge. That is the great person. Now, in that respect, if that is the greatest person, the greatest person is the man who is endlessly inquisitive, who always wants to gain knowledge, always intellectually curious, like a child. He's, in a sense, the greatest man is really has a certain childlikeness about him, and that is that he's curious like a child. He never loses that curiosity and that search for knowledge. If that's the case, in that respect, the Ben Noach can do just as well as the Ben Israel, because he, when I say just so, I don't mean exactly, because there's certain limitations, but basically, he could do just as well. Because, as you know, the statement of the rabbis, that a Ben Noach that is considered like a high priest, he's considered like the greatest individual. Which Ben Noach? The Ben Noach that is involved in the study, in his study of Torah, in the study of halacha, in the study of philosophy. And that's endless. That's endless. I mean, you cannot complete it in a lifetime. It's infinite, basically. The halacha is infinite, and the philosophy of Torah and the psychology of Torah is an infinite study. The Ben Noach that wishes to gain, to have the good life, must develop that love of knowledge and the love of Torah. That's something that and not just the Ben, I mean the Ben Israel, everyone. That is where perfection lies. Perfection lies there. So if that's where imperfection lies, in that respect there is no difference. That's why, again, actually the two parts of your question are related in a way, because your question was, well, what do we gain from Abraham? You're not going to gain anything from Abraham if you just do a Bible reading, but if you do a Bible studying, and if you're drawn to questions, and you take the text and you analyze it, and you ask questions, what is this, why is this verse before that, what is going on here, what is the Torah trying to teach me on a deeper level, and then you come to an understanding of what's going on, you will see profound psychology, philosophy, metaphysical ideas, ideas about prophecy, different areas which will raise you to a higher level, because it will involve your soul in its true function, which is the pursuit of knowledge. The pursuit of knowledge. That's what that's the real function of the human soul. That's why people are not happy. People aren't happy is because, I often say, people are not happy because they think they know what happiness is. Why do they think they know what happiness is? Because one time they may have been at a dinner and they got an award and they felt so good that moment. They said, that's happiness. If I can only be like that all my life, I'll be so happy. But that is silly, because that emotion is intrinsically a person cannot enjoy for more than it's a momentary thing. That's all it is. You can't have that all the time. So that is not what man was made for. If that is what man was made for, so then he would be constructed in a way that he could always enjoy that. But he can't. It's only a moment, very short moments in most people's lives. So the ego trip of man is not what man was made for. But there is something a person can always enjoy, and that is the pursuit of knowledge, the humble pursuit of knowledge. If a person can do that, he can be a happy person, and he can have a wonderful life. He will not be bothered about the fact that the next fellow is getting ahead, or the next fellow got this award, or this honor, or this doesn't bother him, because he knows the true treasures are really, what does the Bible say? They are as close, they are in your mouth and in your heart. You don't have to go traveling across the sea. You don't have to do anything. It's right there in front of you. All you have to do is just open up your eyes and realize how did God create a man what makes man happy? And study the Bible. Study Adam. What did Adam do? Adam is was studying the animals, classifying them, trying to understand them. He's looking at God's creation. The first man, the fresh creation of the universe is before him. And what does he do? He's trying to understand, why is this animal this way, and then the other animal, how their instincts work, how they're structured. He was curious, and he was intellectually functioning. That becomes very clear when you read the first chapter in Genesis. So you say, what does Genesis have to do with us? There's a primary example. It has a lot to do with us. It gives you the basic philosophy. Adam was the man. With regard to Christianity and to other similar religions, messianic religions, I often say, if messianics is what we were created for, what did Adam do? Here God created man. He must have given him something, an opportunity to fulfill himself. After all, God doesn't create a creature without giving that creature what it needs, just like in the rest of the animal kingdom. Each creature has its place and its life and its function. Well, what was man supposed to do? There's no messianics then. So obviously, and again, when you read the Torah, you see, he was studying. He was in pursuit of knowledge. That is what makes man happy, because that is something a person can endlessly be involved in. It's very close and very easy for him, and it's something which really should be totally pleasurable and shouldn't afford him any pain whatsoever. Whereas the other pursuits the other endeavors of a human being always involve pain, always, no matter what that pursuit is. But the pursuit of knowledge is pure pleasure, because when you don't understand something, your mind is drawn there and you're curious. That's enjoyable. Then if you get a solution, so then that's even more enjoyable. And if you don't get a solution, at least you walk away with knowing that I have more knowledge than I did before, because before I thought I understood it, and now I see that is wrong. So now again I've gained. In knowledge, a person is always gaining. There should be nothing in knowledge that is painful. The unfortunate thing is that the reason why people find knowledge painful sometimes is because their ego is hurt. They say, well, that guy got the answer before me. Well, that bothers me. Well, that's not knowledge. That's ego again. So the point I'm trying to make is that the happiness that the Torah presents for the children of Israel is the same happiness that the children of Noah can enjoy. It's really the same thing, and the Torah is presenting it for the entire world. The halachic system is different. And there is no question that the halachic system for the Ben Israel is much, much more structured in a particular way so that he avoids certain pitfalls and he's directed towards this kind of life. But that's what the whole halachic system really is geared for. It's to direct the person towards life. In that respect, the Ben Noach has it much more difficult. Because I'll give you an example. If I get up in the morning on Sukkos, I take a lulav. Immediately, certain questions arise. Halachic questions. Just a second. What about this or that or the certain things? Whenever you do these commandments, they are very intricate and very precise. So the mere doing of the commandments raises different questions in a person's mind. If he's open-minded, I mean, you could do anything with it and just turn your head off, but if you're open-minded, it has a natural, there's a natural response in the person that does it, and he starts thinking of questions. Now I get in a discussion with some students or my son, and we can spend hours. So the performance of the mitzvos really is something which brings a person closer to knowledge, because there's so many more things going on that have to do with halachic, with the science of halacha. So, questions all the time. Just this week, I had a question of what kind of a blessing to make in a certain situation. A certain situation arose. There are always things coming up. So, in that respect, the Ben Israel has an advantage because he's always in this framework. But Ben Noah has a right to accept upon himself commandments on a voluntary basis. And as we proceed, this week I think we had a little bit of a digression, but as we proceed, I'm going to show you that the concept of the seven laws of Noah being seven for the Gentiles is completely erroneous, completely erroneous. And we'll see that as we study the Talmud, because the advantage of studying the Talmud is that you have at your disposal the greatest scholars from time immemorial. You have all these positions of the great scholars, and they open up the areas, and it's like a flood of light on the text of the Torah and the concepts behind it. So Talmud is really not a dogmatic study at all. Talmud is we thank God that we have the Talmud carried down to us so accurately that we have the advantage of these great minds that help us analyze the texts of the Bible and understand the halacha and the concepts and the philosophical and halacha concepts behind it. So, but the point is that the Ben Noach, if he wants to, he can accept upon himself additional commandments and mitzvos, and in which case he would be permitted to study those areas as well. But my point is this, that it may be easier for the Ben Israel because the system itself is so tight around him that he's constantly bumping into problems, so to speak, to entice him more. But that doesn't mean that the Ben Noach can't do it on his own motivation. Certainly, he certainly can. And there are plenty of things that he should be thinking about also, about the and then studying and pursuing knowledge. That is really what the good life is. The good life is a recognition of the fact that man was created for one thing. Man was created as divine element. What is divine about man is his ability to see a world of reality beyond the physical. That's the world of ideas and the world of concepts, the world of knowledge. So if a person is in tune with that concept, he will have a very, very good, very happy life. What's unfortunate is that the world, the way it is so distorted that it's not available. You can't blame God for what man does. You see, man has free will, and man has free will as an individual and also as a group. But as a group, the free will of man up to today's date did not really express itself too well. I mean, the nations of the world did not embrace the ideas of Torah. They embraced pagan ideas. And they made knowledge, on the contrary, they frown upon knowledge, and they made it unavailable. And the reason why Ben Noach today has such a difficult time is because it's unavailable. If Ben Noach is curious about the details of what theft, what are the components of theft, and specific laws, a lot of important specifics that go on constantly. What about income tax? What about the different so many different areas? But he has no one to consult because what there should have been is at this stage there should have been developed scholars among the B'nai Noach themselves that know their areas and that are really brilliant scholars in their areas, and then they would have students and all this knowledge would have been available to people, and people would be raised with the concept of studying. And you know, when the Talmud talks about the study, it talks about the air, like it says, the air in Israel makes a person wise. What it means is, it doesn't mean just the breathing of the air. That doesn't do it. That doesn't. There's no difference. The same components of air in Israel, same everywhere else. What it means is.
Rabbi, we got 1 minute.
1 minute. Okay.
All right.
What it means is when you develop an intellectual environment, and that's what Jerusalem was the city of wise men. It means the whole atmosphere affects everyone, and everyone sees and everyone is turned towards, is geared towards knowledge, and it becomes easy and enjoyable, much easier to study and to be involved in study when you have such a society. We as human beings have failed, and we haven't been able to produce such a society to this point. But it's not the Torah that's a failure; it's us that is a failure. And what we have to do, and thank God what we are doing, is we are making small steps in correcting it. But we have to realize during the process that we are handicapped, and that's why we run into many problems that we wouldn't have run in had we taken the advice that God gave many years ago and established the proper kind of society. Okay, I guess I'm running into that last minute on that tape there. I don't want to hit the reel.
Okay, that took...